And the I'm good old sure we will not be your friend license. Well,
wow. My childhood was licensed under that license.
NYF public license.
Good morning, listeners. Well, good morning if, for the first time in a very long time, Jono actually remembers to edit this as he should. If not, good afternoon, yes, or potentially good evening. It's Thursday, August 10th. This is Bad Voltage. My name's Jeremy.
Thank you for that, by the way.
That's you like that. That's what happens once in a row, or one time. Once in a row is not a thing. Yeah. One time, total forgiveness. Two times in a row, bollocking.
That's
how that will work.
You know what? Your point is almost as good as your intro.
I think it's great. Also, if you look here on my desk, my mouse, right, is one mouse in a row. So that's okay.
I think that's the name of the show, by the way.
Yeah, that is absolutely anyway. The name of the show.
with that out of the way, what are we talking about today?
Well, we're gonna obviously do a bit of news, but we're also going to talk about content management systems and building websites. So we're going to talk about which CMSs we're fans of, which ones we're not fans of, whether it's dynamic sites like WordPress, or we're talking about static like Jekyll, whatever else, and plugins and SEO and all kinds of stuff. So we're going to dig into that.
Quite a large sidebar on that one as well. So it's only about half about CMSs. So yes, stay tuned for half mystery content.
And we're going to talk about curated journalism. Ben Thompson from Stratechery came up with an idea about essentially outsourcing all the stuff that isn't journalism to a company. And we're going to go through the detail of it.
And now, Bad Voltage.
It's time. You know what it's time for?
I do. In fact, what is it time for?
I think it's time for some news, right?
It is. It's absolutely. So, who's going first?
I know. I do want to. I can go first if you want.
Why don't we let you go first? I don't think you've gone first yet, or I just don't remember.
or care for that matter. So I'm gonna share a piece of news that I'm sure pretty much everybody has already heard about. Because it's been all over the internet in the last couple of days. So there was a Google employee. Wrote a pretty divisive memo. Memo is a kind way of describing it. It's like a 10-page like missive, from what I understand. I, like many of you, haven't had the heart to go and read that. I did a bit of a scan over it. Anyway, he wrote this thing about diversity, and he talked about how he believes that Google's got an echo chamber that relates to diversity, and that people who have conservative viewpoints are going to be slammed, and that women can't work in technical jobs because of biological reasons and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, it turns out that the CEO of Google, Sundar Pichai, is that how you pronounce his name? Pichai? I don't know how to pronounce his last name. He came back from holiday early to kind of deal with this shitstorm that was all over the internet, and now the employee in question has been fired. This guy called James Damore. Well, Google won't comment whether he's been fired or not because they don't comment on individual employee matters. But
he's confirmed he was fired, though.
Oh, he has. Yeah,
he wrote this thing and he no longer has a job. Draw your own conclusions.
Right. So, and he's claiming that he's going to sue them. And anyway, so as you can imagine, there's been some people who have been applauding his firing. There's been some people who have been condemning his firing. I went and looked on Twitter last night, actually, at the hashtag Google memo, Twitter search. And there was a bit of a mix. There were some people who were saying, oh, well, obviously this guy's got antiquated, ridiculous viewpoints and he's been fired and that's a good thing. And there were some people saying the guy was talking about it being an echo chamber and he gets fired. It's proven his point. We'll leave you to decide on that one. I kicked off a discussion on the Bad Voltage forum because I'm interested in people's viewpoints on this. And I was pleased that we had a really nice conversation about religion. It didn't turn into a mess. I want to be very clear about this, okay? Be respectful on our forum, okay? That's the only rule that we have. Like, share whatever viewpoint you have. But I'd be interested to hear the community's view on that. Anyway, what's next? Oh, what do you guys think? I mean, I've just rambled for the last 3 minutes. I mean, but do you want to talk about it or do you want to move on?
This is way too big a topic to be a news item.
You're right. It is.
Well, the discussion certainly is far too long to be a news item.
This is like 3 shows worth of discussion.
Yes.
So
you're not kidding, right? Bloke's a dick. So next.
I'll go next. So it looks like GR Security is going to sue Bruce Perens. And for those of you not familiar with Bruce Perens, he's been in the open source community for a long time. For those of you not familiar with GR Security, they offer Linux kernel security patches on a paid-for subscription basis. And as a while ago, Bruce Perens kind of said he thought they were violating the GPL2 by adding additional restrictions. And now they're not only suing him, they're suing him, his web host, and as yet, unidentified defendants who helped him draft the post, and they're suing him for defamation and business interference. So,
Jesus Christ.
Have you seen this?
No. Yes.
I have not seen this.
I think
suing Bruce Perens. That's like suing freaking Alta Vista.
Right. So, there are a couple of things here. First of all, we, the Bad Voltage team, do not have an opinion on this particular case.
Well, we do. It's just not legal advice or legal opinion.
No. You see, Mr. Perens himself said, I'm not a lawyer. He didn't actually include the magic letters I-A-N-A-L, and that may be why he got sued. But he does say, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an attorney, but I do advise attorneys. This is not legal advice, or that, and got sued anyway. So, given that we are dealing with a group of people who are clearly highly litigious and annoyed, we don't have an opinion.
I agree.
But it does seem like a worrying extra step to take, right?
Yeah. So for those of you maybe not familiar with GR Security, for a long time they offered their patches upstream, and then they made it so that only their beta patches were released to non-customers, and then in April they stopped that and basically put a clause in their subscription agreement saying that customers who redistribute the code, which is licensed under the GPLv2, will no longer be customers, will be terminated, and will lose their right to distribute subsequent versions of the software. So that's the additional clause that they put in there.
Yeah, and what Perrin says is that's not allowed under the GPL version 2 because it's adding an additional restriction. I'm sure I've seen things like this before. I mean, this is similar to, it's not the same as, but it seems similar to Red Hat's thing about if you redistribute stuff, then we won't sell you support and we'll cut you off from the support contract and all that kind of thing.
They never really did that, though. What they did is wrap the copyright into the packages and then use trademark to not allow you to use their logo.
Yeah, no, okay, no, that's
which
fair.
Is a completely different thing. They were just saying you can't use our logo and you obviously can't call it Red Hat. If you respin it like CentOS did, then it's fine.
The thing which annoys me about this is I'm sure I remember someone else doing this in the past, saying, here's this thing, yes, it's open source, but we don't want you to distribute it like this. And if you do, we're gonna cut you off from future versions. I mean, we can't stop you obtaining them some other way. That's the way open source works, but we will not give them to you. And I'm sure someone else does this, and I spent a good hour searching for it and couldn't find who it was. So now I think I may have just made it up in my head. But it's, the thing I think is interesting about this is not necessarily exactly which side you come down on, or whether that's an additional GPL2 restriction or not, is a discussion to be had between lawyers, so on and so forth. But the idea that someone has said, I think this, and they've sued because it makes them look bad, because it makes their business look bad and worrying, it seems, you know, wolf in the hen house a bit, do we not think?
I mean, I don't know. I'm just looking up this company.
They have such a storied checkered history with the Linux, because I mean, they got into the tirade with Linux, called them garbage. That was a while ago. So I mean, this is not the first incident to happen with them.
They have constantly maintained an out of tree set of security patches, and there are a bunch of people who think that the stuff they provide is good and people should be using these patches. They haven't gone upstream because a lot of the upstream kernel team don't like the way they're written, the way they're managed.
And the way they were submitted as one giant patch.
Right, okay. I don't know about the detail here, but there's certainly been a lot of back and forth with this, and they basically maintained a separate out of tree Essentially, you get their kernel rather than the upstream kernel, kind of, right?
I can't find any information about any investment in this company. They seem like a privately held company.
Yes.
So, yeah, pretty sure they're.
And I'm guessing, so my view on this is going to be simple. Like, as far as I'm aware, like, you know, pursuing a defamation lawsuit costs a lot of money, right? They're going to need, where's this money coming from? I mean, this seems like I don't know who the CEO of GR Security is, but it seems like an executive or a CEO or something like that has got really annoyed with Bruce Perens and is this, and this will be dropped later on. I'd be very surprised if this actually goes to court. So,
a lot of publicity.
What do I know? I am not a lawyer.
One last addition to this. Are you thinking, Ack, of the free RTOS license that was the GPL with an additional restriction from a while back?
I might be. I'm sure I remember.
That's the only one I can think of.
I don't think it was that, but maybe it was. And I'm sure I'll be corrected 1,000 times on the forum, on Twitter or whatever. But I'm sure someone did a whole, here it is, yeah, it's open source, but if you take it and then just sell it on, then the next time a new version comes out, we won't give it to you. Sucks to be you. And everyone was like, well, that seems not very open sourcey. And they went, well, you know, it's not against the license. We can't stop them redistributing it. But we can say we won't be your friend if you do.
Yep.
The good old sure we will not be your friend license.
Well,
wow. My childhood was licensed under that license.
NYF public license.
Okay. What's next?
Right. Here in the UK, the Information Commissioner's Office, they're the people who enforce the Data Protection Act and data protection stuff generally. So things about data privacy and what companies are allowed to do with personal information about you and so on and so forth, right? They're getting a bit worried about the fact that a lot of UK government employees, especially tech employees and so on, use Slack. And the reason they're worried about this, I mean, at first I thought, bloody Luddites, get over it. Right, well, what do you want to use Mattermost? But actually,
hey, that's not fair to the Mattermost team.
No, it isn't. That was unfair because I quite like Mattermost actually.
Right.
I should have said, what do you want to use IRC? But actually, they have sort of a point. Right. There are different rules if you're working for the government, because you've got things like freedom of information requests. If someone sends a freedom of information request saying, what was the decision process that caused us to use this particular technology on this governmental website 12 months ago, then you have to be able to answer that question. You might say it's too much effort to produce it, but you ought to be able to get the information and get it reviewed and so on. And that's really hard to do. If it was done on Slack, it was over 10,000 messages ago, and now it's gone. Right?
So the issue here is not just the fact that it's on a Slack's back end. It's that Slack is just a stream of consciousness, like other chat channels.
Well, part of the thing is some people actually did submit a couple of freedom of information requests, and the department in question said, we can't do that, basically because it would take us too long to go through the last 4 months of mindless babbling about what's in the news to find the actual important work conversation. And so we're not going to do it because it would take too much money, which is a reasonable argument. But equally, the ICO are like, dude, you can't do that. You can't just go, nah, it'd be too hard because we haven't made it easy. And this is only a problem because we're now all using Slack for everything, right? In the old days, everything was emails and it was just, you still had it. You know, it didn't go behind a portcullis after 10,000 messages. It wasn't stored on someone else's server. If you close down the session, then it's not gone forever, you know. And so I think there's an interesting kind of a bind here where you don't want to say, and the ICO don't want to say, you all have to use email or some crusty old system just because it's all backed up. But equally, you can't just hand wave things like freedom of information request requirements just because we want to be on Slack because it's easier.
So, I mean, Slack does have a compliance export feature specifically for this problem, but it's only on paid-for plans. So, just like with email, I mean, email doesn't have any inherent compliance archiving built into it. If you use, you know, Exchange or whatever, that's an additional option that you can enable, but that's a technology problem. With Slack, it's just a technology problem. You pay for Exchange, pay for Slack, and enable compliance export if you're a government that has compliance restrictions or compliance obligations.
But isn't the question here less about the compliance piece? It's more about finding that needle in the haystack of lines of Slack discussion. that's very much like email is easier for that because email's better organized, right? Your inbox is really, it's kind of like a discourse forum, right? It's separated out by topics generally.
But if you're a government like the NHS or something that has 100,000 employees, if your compliance pipeline is going to look very similar. It's just a matter of being able to search the text.
This is what I thought was interesting. I mean, I think one of the distinctions between email and Slack is that Slack is full of a bunch of mindless chat and email is less so.
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, you don't ask... You generally don't, like, start a conversation on email with, how's the kids? But on Slack, you will, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think this is a wider discussion beyond this. Yeah. I think the answer to this is enable compliance if you are subject to compliance-related issues.
The
ephemeral nature of Slack in general and the impact that it has, especially in the office, is a topic I would love to discuss because I have strong opinions.
Yeah. I would like to talk about this. I have strong opinions.
I don't know what happens if you get a Freedom of Information request and you say, we never wrote any of that down. We just stood around the water cooler and talked about it.
Which also so happens. Back in the day, I'm sure it happened in that Lotus Notes had that messaging app. I'm sure stuff happened in that. Like, this is not a new problem.
So I'd be interested just to hear what people think about it, you know, one way or the other. Is this sort of thing a problem? I mean, as you say, one way to do it is just, you know, pay for the Slack plan. But then that's taxpayer money, right? So,
or use Mattermost. Use Mattermost.
Or use Mattermost rather than Slack, which we should be doing anyway, right?
Or use Discourse. Discourse and Mattermost is the solutions that you're looking for, government. Excellent. Well,
V Bulletin 4 and IRC, but yeah.
I felt like that was the right time, that pause right there, to make a snide jab about how, England is basically, you know, CCTV, police state. We have all of your information. We're trying to ban stuff, just mainly to annoy you, Mr. Langridge, because you come to America and you claim that this place is bad, but Jesus, what's going on over there?
Right. I'm not disagreeing with you. I told you the story about the band, right? When they first brought CCTV cameras in, someone allegedly, I never found out whether it was the truth or not, got their band out into the street and then played a gig in front of it and then requested the video under Freedom of Information and put it out as the video for their single.
Oh,
really?
Yeah,
this is like the story about the guy with the picture of the handcuffs, right? I'm not sure it actually happened.
I also remember some people, like, didn't someone get married in front of a camera and ask for the video?
That's funny.
They had to pay like the £5 for the video, whatever it was. So. There we go.
Although, I'll give one quick update too. Based on our last show, I posted the same question that we asked in our forum about what was your first computer to LQ.
You did.
And what made me think of this is the vast difference between England and the United States. Acorn, which did quite well in our poll, got a resounding, it was at about 1.6%, and I kind of poked Stewart a little bit, and he put out a large effort, which has got it up to 1.8%.
Oh, man, really?
It is getting pummeled by basically everything else. It's gotten 8
votes.
So
you're basically saying... You're basically saying Linux desktop usage is the same as Acorn usage for people who go on.
But it was interesting. I mean, we have a fairly large UK. I would say UK is probably our third largest, but United States is by far number one. And so it's like, you know, Commodore got almost 20%. I was surprised IBM compatible PC only got 15%.
I bet, baby, this is also kind of an age thing. In order for an Acorn computer to be your first computer, you have to be roughly my age and British.
Right. But IBM compatible, if it was skewed super young, would have had higher than 15%, I would think.
You have to be roughly your age, British, and rich kid.
Fair.
Let's not forget that piece, you
remember your biggest problem is, technically, I can't vote for it because my first computer was a Sinclair ZX81. It wasn't an Acorn at all.
Ah, that's good. You had a peasant's computer first.
I did. With its one brutal K of RAM. Right, anyway.
Although that was popular. Sinclair got almost 12%, 11.58% is Sinclair.
Ah, you see, there you go. Right? I mean, I voted. I voted the MP poll. Okay, end of the news.
So, many of us who are on this segment and listening to this segment have websites. And
are there many people without a website in this day and age? I suppose everyone's just everyone's just got a WhatsApp.
Not a well thought out intro.
It's not a great intro, is it? So some people have a Wix website. Some people will have their own self-hosted Drupal or WordPress or whatever. So we thought it might be interesting to kind of just have a bit of a chit chat about our thoughts on, you know, CMSs, plugins, and various other bits and pieces. I have a number of opinions on this. How do you want to do this? I mean, we really haven't thought this segment out very well. So no. Should I just blast through some thoughts on what I'd recommend here?
Well, this segment was your idea, so why don't you blast through what you had, and then Stuart and I will pitch in our opinions after that.
Mock.
Yeah.
I mean, contribute.
So I, so as a bit of history, I, like many people, I built my own website years ago. I built my own little custom CMS and it was okay, but then I just ran out of time and I'm not a great programmer, as we've already covered,
ad
nauseum on this show. So I moved over to WordPress and I love WordPress. I think it's a fantastic platform for not just setting up blogs, but also building like full websites. You got to keep it up to date, obviously, because as what was his name? Chris Jones once said, having a PHP application in your data center is like letting a bus full of hackers into your data center. So I run WordPress, and theming wise, I'm a big fan of this theme called Divi. Now it's a paid for theme, but it's super flexible. You can basically create really custom layouts, but it's got like a visual builder, so you don't have to write any code. It's pretty flexible in what you can do. It's got like A/B testing, which I don't really use very much of, but it's just a really powerful theme. It's responsive and all the rest of it. And I'm also use a ton of different plugins, obviously. So things like Monarch for social media buttons. This is also from the same company who makes Divi, which is a company called Elegant Themes, and they do a really nice job. They've got great documentation. When I bought Divi, they actually had a lifetime plan. I don't know if they still have this thing where you basically paid like $200 and you basically get all of their themes and all of the updates for life. And so it's like a killer deal. And I run it on a bunch of different websites. So I use Monarch, which is a really neat kind of like social media sharing tool. They've got something called Bloom, which is for people to sign up for like newsletters and things like that. I have like a newsletter. Whenever I post a new blog post, people can subscribe to it, and it goes out to people via MailChimp. And then I also use something called Yoast, which is basically for SEO. So what happens is that when you type up a new blog post, it will give you feedback about how to optimize your copy for SEO, and it'll do things like create a sitemap for you and whatever else. So that's tends to be what I tend to use. I'm a big fan of WordPress, but I've found that Divi and these other bits and pieces, it's amazing what you can do if you spend a bit of time learning about it, you know?
Right.
What about you guys?
So, I mean, I've been in the web industry, I guess, for a long time. So I've gone through kind of a couple phases here. You know, I worked at a web design company, a pretty large web design company from 99 to like 2004 or something. And then from there, a bunch of my initial clients especially were web design companies and web design firms. I remember the whole Mambo to Joomla thing, and you know, we used Geeklog for a while, and then Typo3 for a while, and the Plone, and the amount of open source CMSs that have been around over the years that kind of went back down memory lane as I was getting ready for this segment. And there were some that I completely even forgot about, like PHP Nuke. Do you remember that one? And
yeah,
there's just been so many.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then,
B2, which became WordPress.
B2, right, Evolution. And it's there's been so many, really. And then we kind of went through a consolidation phase where some of those are still around, but it kind of was WordPress and Drupal seemed to have a lot more mind share than a lot of them, and companies behind them, unlike some of them. And Joomla obviously still there, and a couple other ones. But the one thing that I found interesting is I'm seeing more and more, especially companies, going towards things like Hugo and Jekyll.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an interesting, almost throwback to 15 years ago when people did it then, because serving CGI and what it was called back then really was kind of CPU intensive and servers couldn't handle a lot of traffic, where now we have fixed that problem but are going back to these kind of things for other reasons. And I think the cool thing about something like Hugo is you can have people use the same GitHub or Git-based workflow as engineers on your other teams. And I think it makes the teams a little bit more cohesive, a little bit more. So, that's one interesting trend in this area I've seen lately.
I'd say particularly for
for tech companies.
Engineers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. There's another one called Grav, which this guy called Andy, who used to be in Andy, I forget his last name, he used to be really involved in Joomla, has been building, and it's that's a pretty cool like static CMS. So
yeah,
There were a bunch of static ones. I mean, you used to have back in the old days, you had things like movable type, which was a kind of hybrid of the two. So it was a web application written in Perl. Actually, but it was CGIs. You didn't run anything on your local machine, but it would then build static pages and use them. So these days, you might think of that as being WordPress, but with WP Supercache turned on all the time.
Or yes.
Built in, right? Because people used to talk about funky caching, which was that it created the page the first time someone viewed it because you didn't want to rebuild an 1800-page website every time you changed anything, so on and so forth. Right? So a bunch of things around that. I'm increasingly annoyed with WordPress personally, for a bunch of different reasons, actually. One of them is that I've been working with a friend of mine who is a designer, and he's been asked to put together some WordPress pages for the company he's currently working for, right? And so he wants to he's doing some designy things. There's a bunch of content on the page, but he wants to, do some design and layout and things like that. And you think, and he's like, okay, so what I want is there's 12 pages here, and I want a link at the bottom which says next page, which goes to the next page. How do you do that? Answer is, you just go looking in the plugin thing for a next page plugin, right? But what if you can't install plugins?
Yeah, that's a good point.
It is spectacularly difficult to do anything interesting with WordPress at all, because there's been this culture of just install a plugin for so long, a whole bunch of really obvious stuff just isn't in the core, because they don't want to bloat the core, I understand that. But if you can't install plugins, if you've got to go cap in hand to the IT team and say, please install this, It makes working on this stuff really, really difficult.
Not just that as well, but if you go to an IT, with many IT teams, and you say, I want this WordPress site and I need these plugins, many IT teams will require a code review, a security audit of each plugin and each new plugin release that comes
down.
If you use five plugins and they release one new release each month, that's tying up that team.
Total nightmare. Yeah. There's also,
it's a real problem.
And plus, just install a plugin leads to myriad security issues.
Oh, it totally does, yeah. Especially since for a whole bunch of these things, you're like, I don't want to use a plugin. What's the solution? And then you'll find 50 Stack Overflow answers or things on the execrable WordPress forum thing, which say, what you do is...
Did you just say execrable?
Yeah, I did. Why?
What is that? Is that Elvish? What is that word?
Appalling, repugnant, hopelessly, dribbly, supernaturally awful WordPress form.
Execrable. Wow. Jesus Christ. That sounds like a progressive death metal band.
Yeah, actually, it does.
Anyway, carry
on. That kind of lightning logo.
right.
So, a lot of them will say, just edit the theme to do this. Just find the bit which says, the post and change it to the excerpt or whatever, right? I'm like, but you can't edit themes either. Also, editing a theme is the world's worst idea. Never, ever, 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 ever do this. It will screw you. And that, combined with the fact that WordPress is popular, right? It's got 23% of the web.
Surprisingly popular, yeah.
Yeah, according to the WordPress team, and it's not entirely clear how they calculate this metric, but whatever, right? It's popular. Because of that, if you set up a WordPress site and you don't say super duper on top of security stuff with it, you will be owned by bots 30 nanoseconds after a security hole is found.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, I mean...
And if you're us, right, then fine, you stay up to date. But when have you ever gone to work with a company where this isn't their absolute job and you've looked at their WordPress, or you've logged into the back end and it hasn't got the upgrade click here banner at the top. It's literally one click. They can't make it any easier. And no one does it still. It's like, oh, yeah, should get around to that. And you've already been owned.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. If you're going to run WordPress, you need to make sure that it's well managed. I think part of the reason why I think it's been successful, obviously, is with the problems that you guys have highlighted, which I agree with, is for people like me who want to build a relatively comprehensive site, you know, like my own personal, like johnabacon.com, you know, it's a blog, but I've also got like stuff about my business on there and this, that, and the other. It's pretty flexible, particularly if you have a decent theme that allows you to that kind of flexibility. The problem with it, one of the major problems that I have with it as well is configuration of like a post template is difficult unless you like Divi can allow you to create a completely custom post theme. But then you're bought into Divi. So yeah. If you ever need to change themes, then you're screwed.
Yeah, an awful lot of these kind of big league WordPress plugins basically throw away the WordPress admin interface. I go, you've got to use our admin interface instead. And it's infuriating. I mean, you can. So if you look at things like management and so on and so forth, and someone's going to look for you, you could say, I'm going to run WordPress, but I'm not going to host it on my own server because that's stupid. Who wants to be a sysadmin? I'll go to WP Engine or someone like that, do the hosting for you. But in my opinion, if you're going to do that, just go to Squarespace. Right? WordPress has the advantage that it has. WordPress has a much has a really wide community, but so much of it's out of date. It's like looking at Linux documentation online where you say, how do you fix this? And you're like, but that was from 2009 and now it doesn't apply anymore.
I think that's an unfair characterization. I think that if you're responsible in the way that you're looking at plugins and whatever else, and you're responsible in the way that you're assessing things like themes, I think you can end up with decent, well-maintained stuff that serves your needs. I think one of the things that WordPress gives you is it gives you a lot of flexibility. You know, you can build CNN with WordPress, or you can build just a simple blog, right? That's one of the things why I think people use it. With something like Squarespace, you lose a lot of that kind of flexibility. Also, there's something about running your own CMSs that, yeah, even if it's hosted on WP Engine, you can always dump that data out and move it to your own hosted provider if necessary, your own, you know, on-prem, whatever, if you need to. I think, to be fair, it's not perfect, and none of these CMSs are perfect, but I think they've done a reasonable job at it.
I would agree with that. The Automatic team do try quite hard, but I think I've decided that the deficits outweigh the benefits. But I see how people have made the other thing. If someone comes to me and says, I want a website, I want to just spin it up, go for it, but I want to be able to customize it the way I like, I'll normally say to them, install WordPress on a hosted platform.
The big issue that I have with this is the same issue that I have with things like GitHub and GitLab, which is, and this is one of the things I was working on when I was at GitHub, is if you go and create a brand new GitHub project, right, a new repo, and you want to build a community around something. So let's say, you're building a game, right? A mobile game. To convert a repo, into an actual community that's up and running and doing really good stuff and healthy and vibrant requires a huge amount of like expertise that's locked up in individuals' heads. And I think it's the same thing with building a website. If you know, just in my own personal experience, I've done a bunch of kind of like experimentation and research around, you know, the way in which you lay out your blog and how you improve your bounce rate and things like that. That kind of stuff just isn't integrated very well into WordPress. It gives you all of the Lego bricks and you have to know how to put those Lego bricks together. And that's why I think something like Wix or Squarespace is good.
Yes.
Is that stuff it's optimized a bit better for SEO. Like that's one of the reasons why I love Yoast, is that I don't know anything about SEO. I can install one plugin and it improves my SEO significantly because it gives me actual shit I can do, not just in terms of the configuration of the site, but how you create content. We need more of that in technology. Like, you know, it's okay for people like us who are really interested in how you optimize web stuff and whatever else. But for the average person who's setting up a blog or setting up a website, they have no idea and they probably have no interest.
Yeah.
It should make it better.
WordPress, the vibrancy of WordPress's community actually works against it to some extent because it's like trying to find hotels online, right? If you think, how do I solve this problem with WordPress? What you don't get is, here is a good answer, which you should do, which works. You get 40 right. billion answers, half of which are outright lies, half of the remaining ones are utterly self-serving and attempting to sell you a product, and most of the remainder are massively out of date. So, and if you're the sort of person who can winnow through all of that and find the one nugget of decent information at the bottom, but you probably didn't need it in the first place.
What do you use, Langridge, for cryogenics?
My personal site's static these days. It's I use Pelican.
Oh, nice.
Because I looked at Jekyll, but it's in Ruby. So these days, if I set up, I'd probably use Nicola rather than Pelican, because Nicola's a bit better supported, but it's Pelican now and I'm not interested in shifting it. The problem with static sites is that it's basically only good if you are the sort of person who always posts from one place. It is quite awkward for me, for example, if I want to write a post and I'm not at my computer. That's fiddly to do. I can do it because I'm me and I can SSH in and run it all off the command line and so on. But that's awkward. And no one, I mean, the original sites, if you look at Dave Weiner's original blogging engine, that was very much, it was a desktop application and you wrote things in and then punched the button and it delivered you an HTML, a folder full of HTML files, which you then FTP'd up to your website, right?
Right.
And there was a whole bunch of incredibly clever technology which basically just did rsync, right? just to speed it up. And I like static stuff for that, but I can't recommend it to anybody else because you've got to have a very clear picture of how all the moving parts actually work in order for it to make sense to you. The movable type model is actually quite a good one, it's just nobody does it anymore. And the movable type people completely screwed themselves by A, charging a bunch of money, and then having Mark Pilgrim write the Freedom Zero post, which basically dropped them down a hole. So...
yeah. You know, it's... This is a bit off topic, but it's related. One of the things that I've become a bit of a fan of recently is Zapier, which, for those of you who are unfamiliar with this, is basically, it's a service where you can connect different things together, right? So essentially,
it's IFTTT, but not IFTTT.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Yeah,
yeah. Who are the car hire company who was like, we're number two, but we try harder?
I don't know.
Was that Hertz or was that Avis?
I've never heard that slogan before.
Oh, okay. Whichever one of them was second, that's Zapier, and the leading one is IFTTT.
Well, they're different.
Not really. Go on, tell me on why they're different then. Maybe I've missed
the
whole point.
Well, I haven't used IFTTT. I haven't used the other one. I've only used Zapier, but as far as I'm aware, they serve quite different use cases. Let me tell you how Zapier works and tell me if this works in the other one. If I go into Zapier, I can basically say create a new Zap, and which is a terrible name, by the way. And then I can say, what's your trigger application? And let's say it's a Google form, right? And then what I want to happen is when somebody adds an entry to the spreadsheet that's attached to a Google form, it will have an outcome, an action, they call it. Now, that could be, for example, I want to add an entry into my CRM, or I want to send an email or whatever it is. And Zapier's basically got a huge library of applications. and what you do is you don't have to write any code or anything like that. You basically say, so for example, if I'll give you an example. One of the things I've done is when I sign a new client, they fill in a Google form, it gathers some information, it puts it into QuickBooks. It creates a new folder in Google Drive for me, and it sends me an email, right? So what it does is it kind of like connects all these different pieces together. So at each step, what it will do is it will pull some sample data, and then it essentially allows you. It's kind of like almost like a mail merge, right? You've got these like bits which might be their name or their header or the address, puts into the next thing. That's how it works.
Yes, that's literally what IFTTT is.
It works in exactly the same way?
I'm not kidding. They're the same thing, I promise, right?
I've got,
for example, when I add things to my shopping list with my Amazon device, I say blah, add blah to the shopping list, but the actual shopping list I care about is in Wunderlist. So what I did was I use IFTTT to hook the two things together. So when a new thing gets added to my Amazon shopping list, that triggers an IFTTT, which they now call applets. They used to be called recipes. And that then goes, okay, a new thing has come in. I will pull some information out of that and then send an email to this address via Gmail. And that email is my dedicated Wunderlist address, which then adds it to my shopping list. And then Niamh can see it.
Yeah, they are almost identical. I mean, IFTTT supports non-web-based things coming from like Android and iOS. And they're basically similar, though. You can do a little bit more complex things with Zapier because they support like multi-chain rules, which by design, they don't with if this and that, but they are legitimately very close to the same thing.
Oh, so you don't have multi-chain with this if this and that.
No.
You'd have to set up multiple.
They call them recipes.
You'd have to set up multiple recipes.
Yeah, you create multiple applets to do it, but yes.
Do you have to write code with if this and that?
No, it's all very click, 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 click.
I would say if this and that is simpler to use. There's less of a learning curve, if you could believe that, not more.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, if this and that is very much, you go, oh, I want to do this, and it gives you really big writing, but just pick
like the
next
Gmail
thing.
Logo
click,
and then the Dropbox logo
thing.
And
click.
Connect them.
Yeah, it's all, you know, like those calculators you get for old people with really big numbers. It's like that, right?
Yes.
Which is great, but what Zapier's selling point is, apart from not occasionally just going, oh, we're not going to kill this, they tend to listen a bit more attentively to calls for new third-party services to add. And they give you a bit more, if you're prepared to dive in a little bit and do a little bit more Kodi-style thinking, you could do a bit more with it. If there's any of that stuff is very much, you can snap the Lego blocks together, but you can't do anything else.
Yeah.
Because they're the big noise. They've got integration with things like Alexa.
Shit. Right.
no, it's okay. I was being really careful there.
does if this then that provide things like, do they have like their own like in Zapier you've got, for example, they've got like convenience functions, like one which is where you can create a new RSS feed and add entries to it, where you can send email to it, another one which is like a filter. Do they have that in if this and that as well?
Yes, sort of, but IFTTT is much more about this thing happens, trigger this other thing, and then it's done. It's not like...
I've always kind of seen them as, if you're a company and you're using it for anything professional, probably use Zapier. If you're at home, probably use IFTTT.
Yeah, if any of you out there remember the late lamented Yahoo pipes, Zapier is about midway in between it and IFTTT, I think.
But either way, whichever one people use, I just this notion of gluing all these different pieces together, it's so handy. Like, you know, one of the things I've been just thinking of is like running my own business. I'm sure that you guys have thought the same thing as well, is how can I reduce the amount of busy work that I have to do so I can focus more on other stuff, you know? And I find that just gluing these different pieces together is so handy. And part of the reason why I was thinking about this was you can use this, for example, to generate blog posts. You know, in WordPress, right? So, you know, if I've got something set up in Zapier so that when, you know, when I publish an article on some of the other sites that I write for, it will automatically update an RSS feed that then will create a WordPress feed in a knowledge base that I'm building.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and stuff like that, that's going to save me a ton of work. So for people who are listening to this who are thinking about, well, I might use WordPress, I might use Pelican, I might use something else, think about, you know, IFTTT or, you know, Zapier and you know, maybe think about that as well.
And that kind of thing is sort of, as I say, because WordPress is the popular one, it develops its own gravity. People will do WordPress integration into things where they haven't done rival stuff because WordPress is popular. And this is the same way as how if you're trying to get software for a Linux desktop, you'll get an Ubuntu one because it's the popular one and probably not for some alternative. Yeah. You know, there is value in picking the popular thing, even if it doesn't do what you want, because it's going to end up being more flexible later because more people will be prepared and interested to work with it.
So, yeah, I think this has got all the grounds for being a fascinating discussion. So get onto community.badvoltage.org. I'd love to hear from people like, what are the CMSs that you're using? What are plugins that you're using? Like, just share some of the interesting infrastructure bits and pieces that you use on your website. Feel free to share what your websites as well, and because I'm sure we've all got a bit to learn it.
So there's this journalist called Ben Thompson. He writes for Stratechery.com is his website. A couple of months ago, he came up with what I thought was a really interesting idea, and I thought I'd get your opinions on it. You've got a model where if you want to produce stuff and have people read it or watch it or whatever, you go to some big curating company who does this kind of thing, right? So if you want to release a record,
right.
you go and get a record deal with a label and then they sell it. Or if you want to make television programs, or you want to be on video, then you go and get a job with a company that makes television programs or a TV channel or something like that, and they then film it and so on. If you want to write, then you go and get a job on a newspaper. And you write op-eds and so on. And we've seen, obviously, anyone listening to this is going to go, well, that's not really the way it is now, because you just put stuff on YouTube, or you just release a podcast, or you write on your own website, or whatever. But if you do that, then there's a lot of kind of heavy lifting you've got to do yourself. Right? If you go and get a job with... if you go and get a record deal, for example, yes, you get screwed over by your label, at least some of the time, and, you know, we all know the stories about that. But equally, what you have to do is record some songs and then go around in a tour bus. At no point do you have to handle pressing of CDs, right, or contacting record shops or any of that stuff. And that stuff's hard. That's the bundled service that the label provides, right? But it's very much the old fashioned model is they do the stuff, customers go to them for it, and you are basically an employee, right? Thompson's suggestion, and this is he's talking generally about journalism, but so not specifically music, but in general, the idea is now that we're in a world where people produce their own stuff and people build their own personal brand, I hate the phrase, but you know what I mean, you won't be thinking,
Everyone's personal brand can be improved, by the way. Everybody can, you know, have great improvements.
Shut up. but people tend to think, you're not thinking, I'll go to the company who provides this. I won't go to the venue. People don't particularly like the idea of I'll go to Netflix to get this thing. It's more, I want this thing off these people. You know, I'll go and listen to Bad Voltage. I'll buy Louis C.K.'s CDs or whatever, you know? And so the theory here is instead of having big companies be the gatekeepers to the market, what you do is people go out and do their own thing, build their own audiences, build their own following, make the connection with the fans, handle that themselves, and then the big company becomes essentially a service provider. So all the bundled stuff that you need to do, you basically subcontract them for it. For things like getting advertising. Right? If you want an advert for your podcast, then you just talk to them and they do it and they take some money off the top and give you that. So you bundle together all the stuff that you need to do which isn't about content creation and essentially buy it off a central company who take, and that's their business model. But it reverses the cause and effect, right? So instead of customers go to the big company and you're an employee of the big company, it's customers come to you, but you employ the big company the same as everyone else does to do all the donkey work that you're not interested in.
So to provide an example, a band, right? One of the things that infuriated me about when I was doing Severed Fifth is I wanted to sell merch to people, right? Sell T-shirts and CDs and whatever else. I absolutely did not want to have to produce it and ship it and all the rest of it. So you could hire a company that basically makes your T-shirts, stores them in a warehouse, and then mails them out to people when they make an order, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but in general, what the large company, the sort of thing that they want is they take payment in terms of some of the money coming in, but they also want ownership of the brand, right?
It's important, I think, to follow this conversation to first read the article. So we're definitely linked to it in the show notes. His main point is that previously, and he uses, I think, the New York Times as an example, they owned the printing presses and they owned the brand. So they owned distribution and they owned the trust. And they generated money through those two things. And now the distribution, the internet has shattered that portion of the equation. So now the trust is moving to individuals, and he uses Grantland as an example. For those of you who are not familiar with him, Bill Simmons used to be on ESPN and built a phenomenal personal brand and left. He went to Medium and started a thing called Grantland, and now he's gone to the example he uses for the quote-unquote faceless publisher is Vox, right? And so Vox will do the ad sales, they will do the hosting, they'll do the infrastructure pieces, they'll do the HR-related things, the things basically that all scale and are, if you are a content producer, minutia, right? You don't want to cut paychecks, you don't want to do Expensify, you don't want to do any of those things, you don't want to worry about web servers and electricity bills and all of that and all of those things. What you want is the website to always be up, and you want to generate good content that excels and continues to build that brand.
Yeah, but publishers in the past have required. In order for them to provide those services to you, part of the thing you had to sign over to them was essentially the brand, right? They were like, no, you don't get to do a thing and get all the credit for it, and we just provide you services in exchange for money. What happens is the brand is ours, and you become an employee of ours. So they had more leverage over this kind of thing. And now the suggestion here is maybe in a world in which people are now capable of building their own personal brands and following through on that, I mean, I'm sure you could have done this in the 50s, but if you decide to leave and run your own TV company, you couldn't. There was just no way of doing it. But now, if someone bails from a really big BBC TV show and then goes somewhere else, they could, in fact, go to Amazon. And the fact they didn't take the name Top Gear doesn't necessarily mean that everyone likes Top Gear. What they liked is the three guys, right?
I haven't read this article, but this all sounds a bit obvious to me. Like, you know, there are YouTube celebrities like the guy who does Unbox Therapy, right? I mean, and he's clearly running his own business. Like, he's hiring people to do his editing, and he's hiring people to do merch, and he's got people who are working with companies to send over stuff that's going to get reviewed. I'm not really sure what's so remarkable.
So that one wouldn't fit this model, though, because he's... What they're talking about are companies like Vox that want to not really have a name themselves and aggregate a bunch of unrelated content generating machines, but not own the machines.
Yeah, what that guy has done.
But why would they do that?
Because they get paid for it.
Because they take 40 to 60% off the top.
Yeah. Anyone who's a big enough deal that they've basically employed people to do all this stuff doesn't need it because they built their own tiny publisher themselves.
The reason this needs to exist from his contention is because of things like YouTube. It's so easy to get your name out there with no effort. But if you want to really make money and really control your brand, in the end, you're going to have to get rid of YouTube in some way. Because there's a cap to what you can do on YouTube or any... There's always a cap to what you can do on someone else's program. And if you're an ad buyer... You basically don't want to deal with 1,000 or 10,000 companies that have good brands but don't generate enough traffic, right? You want to go to YouTube or Google, really, cut one giant check and get billions and billions and billions of views. But I think what people are starting to realize is you're not maybe getting the highest quality billion views, but ad companies don't have the time to go to Bill Simmons and say, we want the little bit amount of views you get, we want that, and then go to every other quality small publisher and do that. Where if Vox aggregated enough of these, they could still write one large check and get higher quality content, their ads on higher quality content, so Vox would in theory be able to charge more. But the thing about ad sales and web infrastructure is they easily scale. You can have a certain sized ad sales team. They can sell one impression or a trillion impressions just as easily. It's just a checkbox. How many impressions do you want?
So if I understand you correctly, then it is kind of the record label model, right? Because if you look at a typical record label,
not really, because they owned distribution and they owned the name, so you couldn't. That you signed a contract.
No,
and you...
labels very rarely own the trademark of the band.
I think Prince would disagree with you.
Material of the band. This is the reason why
I think Kesha would disagree with
labels.
You. I think the numerous, unending, but over 100-year lawsuits would all disagree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure it depends on the label, but my point is there are thousands and thousands of examples of bands switching labels.
Right, after their contract's up.
Yeah.
Right.
But this is the, but the,
I mean, yes, there's contractual obligations. My point, though, is that when you sign to a record label, you typically don't sign over they don't own the trademark for your band. You have a contractual obligation for a set number of releases.
The idea here is that there's potentially a reversal of fortune available here. Instead of you competing to get a record deal, why not have labels compete to get your stuff? And you might say, well, what the hell's in it for the existing labels? The answer is nothing's in it for the existing labels. But it feels like there could be a market for new people to come along and say, okay, instead of setting up like a traditional record label and having you people grovel to be blessed by our distribution network, we will try and sell our distribution network to people out there who are making music.
I think the main difference here compared to the traditional music industry, which is what you're considering, there's a set number of large labels that basically control what gets played. And if you're not on one of those labels, it's very, very, very difficult to make it. This is an inversion of that model.
Yeah, and think about it in terms of something like journalism, which is where he's coming from. Rather than music, is a bit weird, but because you don't really have the label model in things like written journalism or video journalism, right? But the idea here is that there's a space in the market, I think, for someone to pop up and say, we're prepared to be this, we'll provide all the back-end stuff for you in exchange for a fee, rather than people standing up and saying, well, we want to own the market and you have to come to us.
Well, I would say that there's two considerations here, right? There is the model that applies to major content producers, like major artists, very famous authors, things like that, right? I would argue that for people like that, you will already have publishers, labels, whoever else, fighting to try and get that person. In the same way that, you know, your example earlier, Ak, of the Top Gear guys leaving the BBC, right? There was a bidding war between Netflix and Amazon and ITV, if I remember right, over their next endeavor. But it sounds like what this guy's talking about more is the long tail of producers. Right, which is way different. But what I don't understand here, and clearly I'm not understanding, so I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this. I think it's more that I don't understand it. Is I don't understand how this is different. Like, first of all, like it sounds like, using the Unbox Therapy dude as an example, he today runs his own business. He owns the brand. He chooses the platform that he delivers his content on, which currently is YouTube. And then he picks a set of service providers who will run his website, who will take care of his merchandise and all that kind of stuff. It sounds like what you're talking about is that an unnamed or a, you know, not publicly named organization will go up to him and say, hey, we will provide all of this stuff for you. And then we will own part of your brand.
No, that's the difference, is they will own none of your brand. You create all the content. Bill Simmons still owns all of Grantland, 100%. They have no control over his content. They have zero ownership in anything to do with it. What they do is provide a service for a fee that includes all the scalable bits that most content producers don't want to have.
But what I'm saying is that...
Think about it more right? Where... your accountant will have loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of clients, and you go to them and go, you handle my accountancy stuff in exchange for this much money every month. It would be like that, but for ads or whatever. It's basically quite hard to do that.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, Unbox Therapy Guy currently provisions a set of services of which they get no brand.
How many employees does he have?
What's different about this?
How many employees does he have?
Probably one.
So this is meant for much larger entities than him. Like, Grantland has dozens of employees with eyes on having hundreds, if not thousands. They want to be a very... So it's not really for the long tail. It's for the meaty part of the middle tail.
But that's also not that different, is it? In the same way that when I was at XPRIZE and we ran the global learning campaign, we outsourced a bunch of the social media stuff to a social media agency.
Yeah, oh, totally.
I guess I'm failing to understand...
I think you'll need to read the article.
Already, When people already are subcontracting out work or outsourcing
at the moment, it's pretty hard to know who to send it out to, and you've got to identify different people in the different areas you want to go for. So you need someone to do your HR stuff, and you need someone to do your ad stuff, and you need someone to handle this, and someone to handle that, and someone to handle the other, and they're all different companies. You've got to shop around. You're essentially building your own little custom bundle from the people that are available. And what you want to do is go, I want this as a bundled service, please.
So you're saying with his thing that let's say you use the example of Vox, right? Let's assume we have a company called Smallpox, because it sounds like Vox. Smallpox goes up to famous Mycroft reviewing YouTuber Stuart Langridge and basically says, I would like to offer you this raft of services. So it's not just advertising; it's also merchandise and it's talent management and whatever else. It's a collection of stuff. We will come up to you. You don't have to give us any of your brand. You just pay us some money, and then we will provide this.
Yeah,
right. Am I correct in assuming?
Think of it as if I wanted to be famous reviewer, but have a program on the BBC, I'd still do roughly the same stuff that I do on YouTube, and they'd handle a bunch of stuff for me. You know, talking to the people to get review items, and who make sure that I get paid at the end of the month, and chasing down new ads for, but not the BBC then, so ITV, right? Chasing down the ads that go in the middle of it, and finding people to do product placement sponsorships, and finding interesting guests, and all this sort of thing would be handled by the television company who were my employer. But it's basically not possible to buy that as a service. What you've got to do is have someone go, I'll sell, you know, you've got to go and work for someone and say, I'll sell you the brand, so you now own my TV program, and in exchange for which I get to star in it. It's that reversal that's the thing. Because people are going out and doing their own thing anyway, but it's quite hard. Once you get to a certain size, if you are someone like Louis C.K., for example, I'm sure he had to go and look at a bunch of people who made DVDs and pick the best one and find people who could do like cover design. And always got it. And it'd be nice if we could just go to someone and go, just handle all this crap for me as if I've got a job.
But it sounds like what this gets to really, then the real value proposition of this, in my mind, is Unbox Therapy guy, right? I don't know him. But it's pretty clear that he's got some entrepreneurial chops, right? Like he started seeing some popularity around his YouTube videos, and he's built a business around it, right? And he's seen opportunities in the marketplace for this, that, and the other to build a business around it. And the reason why he succeeded is because he has entrepreneurial chops. In the same way that there are a good example of this is the band Overkill. Huge fan of Overkill. They run their own business. They have their own label. They work with distributors, but the guy who is the singer in Overkill, he owns like three or four different businesses, so he knows how to make Overkill into a successful band. It sounds like what this is approaching the angle of, and I do see the value of this, is for people who lack the entrepreneurial chops, they're just good creators. It's basically it's a manager. It's a manager with a set of services that apply to it. In the same way that, you know, bands that succeed have good managers. They're able to coordinate.
No, that's a fair way of looking at it.
It's management with services, which I think is interesting. I just don't. I think this has already happened.
That's the thing. It exactly isn't at the moment. And I think what he's talking about is that it could do. That there's a space in the market for this to exist, but no one actually provides it. It's a good idea. Yes, it is.
It's good, but it's a risky idea.
It is, which is why there needs to. It can't be done by some little company. It's got to be done by someone who's big enough that they can absorb a couple of years of it not working out very well in order to build their brand.
Until you build
among
the scale,
content
it's not
going to
work very well.
Yeah. So they'd have a very visible brand, but it'd be visible to content creators, not to the public. Right. I mean, essentially, this harks back to the earlier conversation we had on this show, right? This is doing for web people who want a website, what Squarespace have done. At the moment, the option you've got is WordPress, which is the Overkill guy. Yeah. Or hiring a shed load of people who do this for you, and that's it, right? But what this
I was
is
literally
this is
about to make the same comparison. Yeah, it really is.
It's Squarespace and Wix. For content
it's exactly
creation,
the same.
Everything other yeah. than the actual
I
content.
I do not like that analogy, but okay. Honestly, though, read the article, and I'm curious if it changes your opinion on it, because I think a little bit of the nuance in the article is getting lost in us not being able to explain it for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And we'll link to the article in the show notes. And also, yes, as usual, this is another kind of neat discussion I think we could have in the forum. Yep. So community.badvoltage.org, share your opinions. And also, I'd like to hear of organizations or artists who are using this model, like where it's working like this. I'd like to see concrete examples of this in action that people might want to suggest.
Absolutely. So, presumably, yes.
Yes,
I do.
All done. Everyone's good. Assuming John actually remembered to mix this, you'll be listening to it.
Again?
I was going to say, do I need to set a timer on your Google Home thing, whatever it is?
Shh. Okay, Google, remind Jono on Wednesday evening to mix the show.
I have headphones on, idiot.
Well, no, but no. The beauty now is everyone else's.
Oh,
Google Home will send you an email, point. Presumably. Hey, I wonder if that works.
Yeah. Let's try it. Let's try it with a few different ones. What is the most efficient way of trolling lots of people?
They've now turned their Alexas and off.
That's a good one. We may have lost the yeah. Okay. But now we just triggered a load of people to do worthless turning off of Alexa.
So
in one way, we did succeed.
Yeah. There was one comment I forgot in the Stratechery segment, actually, before I forget. So that was pointed out to Stuart. Unlike Mr. Bacon, I actually read the article and was so impressed with the content, I subscribed. So he has a model where you pay to subscribe. He does like a weekly or twice weekly long form post that is completely free, but then a daily email update that they charge for. So I subscribed to see. He has pretty strong opinions on multiple different future forms of publishing, if you will. Most of the articles are not about that subject. They're just kind of about random tech-related things. And so far, it's been pretty interesting. Unfortunately, he's been on vacation, so I haven't got a ton of the content, but you do get access to the archives as well. And two cool things I thought about the email were, one, he made an assertion, and someone pointed out that he missed something in the data. And he wrote a whole separate email saying he was wrong and why he was wrong and thanking the person. So he's very well researched, but when he gets it wrong, he's very willing to point that out and reform his opinion, which I liked.
I admire people like that.
Yeah. At the bottom of the email, it says, thank you for subscribing. This email is for you, but we don't mind if you occasionally forward these on. Go ahead and do so, which I also thought was pretty cool.
How much do you have to pay for this?
It was like $5, I think.
$5? How often?
A month, I believe.
Like a month or something like that? Okay.
Yeah.
It's not much. It seems like
$3, something. I don't
know. A good model, you know?
Well, yeah, I had Patreon. Never subscribed to something like that before, so I was curious. So I'm going to give it a couple month shot to see what the potential future of journalism may look like.
And then report back. Absolutely.
I think I know what it's going to look like.
A big smoking hole in the ground, perhaps.
I hope it isn't, because I think people are good creators of any form. You know, on a related note, one of the things I love about where we are today, technological-wise, is like I watch, you know, TV shows and whatever else, listen to music, you know, Spotify, Netflix, Amazon. I love the fact that even though it's like a pittance, for example, with Spotify, at least when I'm listening to music, the artist is getting some kind of remuneration. It's not like ripping music off the internet. Like there was that Napster phase where people were downloading music illegally constantly. I'm glad that there are some methods in which people can get paid.
I had no idea that you could salvage your conscience by paying 0.0004p every time you played a thing.
I think it's better than downloading music illegally. It's not much better.
Really is not much better. Like, it's about $8 a month better.
And you give me a better model
for the artist.
I can get all of it. You give me a better model in which I can get all of the music I want to listen to, and I'd happily pay twice the Spotify subscription and have people get more money. Like, I want artists to get paid, obviously.
I was
going to
say, part of the reason artists get paid so little in that model is because of the labels. So I don't think it's completely fair to Spotify.
Right.
I mean, there's still a lot to figure out in that industry, but I agree with Jono. It's better than just taking it and stealing it.
Yeah, I sort of see your point. But equally, the whole kind of, well, you come up with another model where I can listen to any song that's ever been recorded, but I'm not prepared to pay more than, say, $20 for it. You're like, well, no, it doesn't work, right? It's like I come up with a model where I can eat all the sandwiches that I want and stay thin. Doesn't work like that.
Well,
you can only play
one
song at a time, though. It's not like you can play all of the songs. And as soon as you stop paying the $20, you get access to no songs.
No songs. Yeah.
Oh, no. Exactly. I can listen to Spotify songs right now, and I don't pay for it.
I'm talking about the paid subscription.
Accounts. Right.
Well, yeah, but you don't actually need to pay for it.
Well, if you want to access any song on Spotify at any time, ad-free, you have to pay for it.
Right, no, ad-free, yes, correct. But what you're doing is you're not paying for access to the music. You're paying to get rid of the ads.
No, I'm paying because I want access to the music and I want to pay the artist. I want to contribute back to the artist.
But I've got access to the music without paying.
Right, and you're a shithead.
Well, so two of us aren't freeloading on music and one is. I'll leave it to the listeners to decide who is who.
Argument one.
That's their thing. That's their business model. I'm not stealing it. Spotify have a downloadable app which does this thing.
Right? My point was this, is that years ago, part of the reason why people ripped off music and movies was because they couldn't access it digitally. They couldn't access it in a form that they could that they could consume it, right? You couldn't get certain movies in the UK. You can get certain albums in the UK. So people ripped it off. My point is this, is that I don't rip anything off. Like, I did download stuff on Napster years ago. I don't rip anything off anymore.
Don't have to now. It's
because
nuts.
Because convenience means that I can access it, and I've obviously got the disposable income where I can pay for it.
Yeah,
I think that's a good thing.
No.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
I agree with that. I wish it and happened with things other than music. But yes,
I agree. With that, I'm going to log off because I have to leave for a meeting. But you two should continue talking. In very respectful ways about my opinion.
That's exactly what's going to happen.
I don't think is going to happen. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm signing out. See
right,
you soon.
Later, Skaya. The other thing I wanted to mention is actually not about Jono, although we should condemn him. I've been playing with a thing called Duolingo recently. Which is a thing for learning languages. Just because bloke on Twitter, Andrew Frey, he tweeted a couple of weeks ago, hey, here's a thing that when I would sit there and browse Twitter, I've installed this Duolingo thing. So now, if he's if he was going to spend 10 minutes just not doing anything, instead he'll spend 10 minutes and learn another four words.
Nice.
Or something. And I thought, well, that seems quite cool.
So, interestingly, it was suggested to me, I'm going to Oktoberfest again, and this time I'm going without Stuart Langridge, who can suddenly sometimes speak very good German. So it was suggested to me that I download Duolingo, actually, and use it to learn as much German as I could in a very short amount of time. So my question to you is, how long have you been using it, how long per day, and how have you found the results to be?
I've been using it a very, very minimal amount, literally 5-10 minutes a day.
Okay.
And for the last 3 or 4 days, I haven't used it at all. So I don't know. I need to get back into it, but it's just been busy times,
sure.
So I don't know, because I've only been doing it a short time. If I need to construct the sentence, the women read, or this is sugar in Italian, I can now do that. I do not feel competent to go and wander around Rome on my own, right? What I don't know is how fast it ramps up.
Okay.
Because basically what it feels like I'm doing at the moment is I'm learning vocab, right? I don't know much about the state of the art of language teaching and how it works. When I was at school, you were taught foreign languages in a way very different from English. So I knew what the perfect tense was, or the future tense, or what adjectives were, and so on, because of French class way before I knew them in English, right? No one taught me to speak English and how to conjugate the future tense.
Sure.
I just never thought about it. But the Duolingo thing is utterly not like that. It's just getting me to kind of read sentences. And it hasn't talked at all about parts of speech or the structure or how it works. None of the academic side of it at all. It's just kind of learn this, which feels like maybe that's a better way to do it. And maybe 40-odd years or 35 years or whatever, 30 years of people being taught languages has had people learn. Maybe the way to do it is not to drill you on third declension nouns or whatever, right?
The semantics of the English language is utter rubbish. So that's, yes. I think part of it compared
now I know about this stuff. Right.
So it's more like Rosetta Stone than traditional.
I've never done anything like this before.
Okay.
I like this because I could just download it and try it out, and it was free. Also, yeah. There's a GNOME Shell extension for it.
Really?
Which is rather nice, yeah. Because you can do it both on the on your phone, there's a native app, or also on the web, which is rather cool. Yeah. And on your phone, it's very much kind of, you know, tapping on boxes. And then there are different things. So sometimes it will say, here is an English sentence, and what's the Italian or whatever language you're learning, right? And you get a little collection of words, like fridge poetry. You know, lots of different words, and you tap on the words to make it. Or sometimes you'll get it the other way around. So here's an Italian sentence. What does that mean in English? But you've got to type that in or tap on the words, whatever. And there'll be it'll read something out in a pre-recorded voice. So one of the nice things is it's actually pre-recorded voices. It's not the voice of Siri or OK Google or whatever.
Is Poppy one of the voices?
Poppy is not one of the voices. Not so far, anyway. Although, I'm not very good at Italian, but I'm better than Poppy is, I suspect. I don't know. I mean, he could well speak a whole bunch of languages, but I don't think he speaks Italian, so we'll find out. I will ask him. So not friend of the show, Alan Pope, unfortunately. But then one of the other ones is it will actually get you to read a sentence. And then it'll listen and then give you a tick mark. So far, I've never got one of those wrong. But I don't know whether that means that I've got a brilliant Italian accent and it's all perfect, or it just listens and then it's really super tolerant about it.
Haven't tried to get one wrong just to see what it does?
I'm worried I might lose points.
They have gamified this thing well.
They have utterly gamified it really well. Actually, you get kind of little gems for doing things. It's like you got to the end of this level and you've got 10 experience points and all this sort of thing. And that's really nice. They've obviously put a great deal of thought into making it as easy as possible.
I have an additional question then. Uh-huh. What's their business model? It's free.
It's not clear to me what their business model is. You can pay to do things like, because I haven't used it for a few days, my points total will have dropped off, and you could pay to stop that happening, like a no-claims insurance bonus, right?
Okay.
I am sort of worried that I get to the end of the basic section and then it goes, now pay $10 or something. I don't know, and I haven't looked into it because the answer's probably going to annoy me. So I do not know if you can use this thing to entirely learn a language without paying any money. If you can, then, you know, great. But like you say, I don't understand how they avoid going bust.
Right.
So far it hasn't cost me anything, and it's fun. If you're just sitting there for 5 minutes, you just go through it and you think, oh, I remember that. Or you think, oh, now what was that? And it's quite a stimulating little thing to do. And they've got loads of languages. Like I say, I picked Italian because I can get by in French and in German if I have to. And Spanish just doesn't seem to fit in my brain. I've tried and it just doesn't work for some reason. And I'd like to be able to speak a little bit of Italian because I like Italy. So yep.
Difficult not to like Italy. So I'm curious, we should pose this to community. Are you using Duolingo or Rosetta Stone or one we haven't heard of? Because this is, I am a... typical American in that I speak no language as well. So I should learn another language or two, to be honest. So I am definitely curious what would be the best way to do that. So community, let me know.
Yes, absolutely. And that's it. You see, we were nice to Jono, despite the fact that he left early. But we should both actually remind him to actually mix the show this time. I mean, the first time, 4 weeks ago, Thursday morning rolls around, and what happens is I release the show, so I'll find the mixed stuff there, and I'll write the show notes and put all that together and then punch the button to release the show. Not there. Send a message to Jono, who is obviously asleep, right? What with being in California and all. And I get a message back saying, oh, yeah, shit, I forgot. So I'm really sorry. I've been really busy. I'm like, okay, fine, no problem, do it. And that was the problem. And then, as Jeremy points out, doing it 2 weeks on the bounce, two times in a row.
Yes.
Muppets.
So,
Muppets.
Better not be three times in a row, Pocodio. Listen up. The best thing about it is he has to listen to this to make sure we've done it right.
Yes, so, he does.
So,
very nice.
End of the show. Thank you very much for listening. We've been Bad Voltage. Good night.